Okay, this is BIO 231, and it is the 28th of September, and we're going to cover some joints today, and maybe move on to a little bit of muscle. We covered some muscles in lab already, I believe. Let's see, but the other thing that you should be aware of is a test, week from today, right? It's a week from today, so it's going to be in this room next Monday. Over the introductory chapter of bones, the axial skeleton, appendicular skeleton, and joints. So four chapters. All right, so did I get that right? I believe that's correct. All right, so what we're covering today will partially be on the test, unless we move into muscles a little bit later. All right, so joints will be on the test. And then what else do you have? Well, just a regular Tuesday night quiz. And then on Wednesday in lab, you've got your muscle quiz. Anybody have that handy? Hold that up. Right? Your online interactive quiz. So just that labeling like that. There's one really weird spelling, the zygomaticus. It's spelled zygomaticus, and I thought that was a typographical error. And then I did a Google on zygomaticus, and that's actually, I think, another way of spelling that particular muscle. That might be a little bit more archaic European way of spelling it, so you'll get points for it, even if you zygomaticus and zygomedicus. Yeah, in your book, it's zygomaticus. That's the preferred way of spelling it, with an A, not an E. All right. So, does anybody have any questions? No. Okay. So this chapter. Might be a little bit more confusing than some chapters because it's just not memorizing structures. It's actually trying to figure out functions a little bit of various joints. And there's some nomenclature that we have to get straight in our minds when we talk about joints. And that nomenclature gets a little confusing. I can only give you a couple little tricks and hints to simplify it. All right, so let me pull open the chapter 9. JPEG as well, while we're at it. Okay, that's good. Nice. All right, and some things in this chapter aren't very difficult at all, like motions. All right, but let's talk about some nomenclature, classification of joints. So as you know, where do you find a joint in your body? Okay. Your elbow is a good example of a joint, but where do you find joints? What the heck is a joint? Yeah, a joint is just where two bones come together, and there's a joint there before they fuse. There's a lot of bones that actually fuse together to form just a single bone, but a lot of bones don't fuse completely. There's actually a joint. All right, and so we can classify joints either by their structural classification, which is what? A nice anatomic classification, or we can classify joints by their functional characteristics, more in terms of their physiology. All right, so, and as a matter of fact, a particular joint, we would maybe want to classify it as both by its structure and its function. So we're going to talk about joints by their structure and function. So the first and easiest class, I think, to understand is a structural classification. Joints can have different components depending on how a joint is put together. So it's based on the material that binds bones together. These can be either fibrous. Take a guess at what the fiber is that is joining bones together. It would be collagen. Okay, collagen fibers. All right, so cartilage is kind of a connective tissue, but collagen would be a fiber. Cartilaginous would be a kind of joint that you just mentioned, where you have cartilage between the bones, and then synovial. Synovial is a pretty complicated joint. It does have membranes, and it has cartilage, and it has fluid, right? And so that's a special joint all by itself, and we're going to have to know this, all the little pieces that make up a synovial joint. But synovial joints actually are the coolest kind of joints because those are the ones that allow you to move around a lot. All right, so besides structural classification, we can also classify joints by their particular function. And some joints are basically immovable joints. And a good example of that would be a suture. Where do we find sutures at?
skull.
In your skull, yeah, bones of the cranium, and even facial bones. So these bones really shouldn't be moving around a lot. Those we call synarthroses. So synarthroses is an immovable joint. There are some joints that are just slightly movable. A good example of that would be the intervertebral joints. So between the vertebral bodies of vertebrae, those you can flex a little bit, extend a little bit, rotate a little bit, but not very much without disrupting that intervertebral disc. Those joints we call amphiarthroses. I don't know what language this is, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me if it's Greek or Latin. I don't know, does anybody see any Latin roots in these words right here? Not necessarily, so probably Greek, okay? And then the last kind of joint by function is what we call a freely movable joint. So these are the joints that are supposed to move, not in any direction, in prescribed directions anyway, but they can move. A good example would be, for instance, the elbow joint, right? And these we call diarthroses, freely movable, right? So if you pull out the first letter of each of these words right here, which is probably not making any sense to anybody, synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis, how are you going to remember what the order is in terms of mobility? Because it spells out sad, right? So S is immovable, D is the most movable. So that's a pretty easy way to remember that, okay? So diarthrosis are freely movable. All right, so let's talk about some joints by their structural classification and see what kind of functions those fibrous joints can make. All right, so a fibrous joint, we got sutures, we got syndesmoses, and gomphoses. A suture is between the bones of the skull and maybe some bones of the face, and these are what? Immovable joints. So an immovable joint, what's a correct, proper language for an immovable joint by function? Yeah, synarthroses. So sutures are all synarthroses because they're immovable. And what do I have? Do I have some kind of picture? Right here. So here is a synarthrosis, and there is collagen fibers, right? So that's a fibrous joint, but it's also immovable, a synarthrosis. All right. Next kind of joint, a syndesmosis, connected exclusively by ligaments, and the amount of movement varies from no movement to slightly movable or even freely movable, depending on what the length of the ligaments are. So what the heck is a ligament, once again? What kind of connection is a ligament? It's a bone-to-bone connection, right? And, for instance, the distal tibiofibular joint, and I do have a picture of that. Maybe, I don't know if I have it on this. Oh, yeah, right here. Here is the distal tibiofibular ligament, all right? It's a syndesmosis, but it's immovable, okay? Another kind, remember there's an interosseous membrane between the tibia and fibula and between the ulna and radius, and your ulna and radius can move freely between each other, right? So that is a diarthrosis, even though it's a fibrous joint. Okay, so the radial ulnar interosseous membrane, that's a diarthrosis, that's a freely movable, and the tibiofibular interosseous membrane is also a diarthrosis. And then this last kind of fibrous joint is what we call a gomphosis. A gomphosis is a peg and socket kind of joint, and that's the joint that we have between our mandible or maxilla and teeth. So here's a pretty nice picture of that. Right here, here's a gomphosis, and that's a synarthrosis. That tooth shouldn't be moving around in there at all. That's an immovable joint. And can you see the periodontal ligament connecting the root of the tooth with the alveolar processes on either side? You know, and every once in a while you might bite into something that you think is soft, but there's actually like a particle in there. Maybe you're eating a hot dog or hamburger or something, and there's a piece of bone, and it kind of tweaks your tooth because you're not ready to bite into that little bone fragment, and that hurts, right? And that's because you just stretched out that periodontal ligament kind of severely. And, you know, it repairs itself, but you definitely feel that pain when you stretch that ligament, the periodontal, right? So peri means surrounding, and anytime you hear that word dentitia or dontal or dentine or denticle or anything like that, you should think of what? Something has to do with a tooth, or it's tooth-like in appearance. Okay. So it's just a ligament that surrounds that tooth right there. All right, so those are the sutures, the syndesmoses, and the gomphoses. Then we have some cartilaginous joints. All right, and what kind of structure, or I mean, what kind of classification is a cartilaginous joint? We're classifying it by structure. What's making up that joint? And in this joint, it's going to be cartilage of some kind. All right, so a synchondrosis, that's a pretty nice giveaway because chondro means cartilage, right? So this is going to be a cartilaginous joint, a structural classification, right? Is united by hyaline cartilage and is immovable. So if it's immovable, what kind of classification by function is it? It's right, SAD, it's the first one, it's the synarthrosis. So some good examples of this would be the epiphyseal discs in bones that are growing. That's a cartilaginous joint. And it should not move. And indeed, if it does move while somebody's growing, then that bone won't probably grow to its normal length. It's going to damage the growth in length. And the manubrial costal joint is also an example of a synchondrosis. Okay, and that's for the first rib. That's for the first rib only, right, the number one. A symphysis is made out of fibrocartilage. So it's not hyaline cartilage, it's fibrocartilage. Some of these are slightly movable. So what's the classification of slightly movable joints? That's the A and SAD, that's the amphiarthrosis. Some good examples of these would be the pubic symphysis and intervertebral discs. I don't know if I have any pictures of these things. Oh yeah. All right, so here's a synchondrosis, and then the fibrocartilage, the symphysis joints in the intervertebral discs, and I don't have the pubic symphysis. But can you remember what the pelvis looks like? Mm-hmm. And right between the pubic bones, there's fibrocartilage. That's called the pubic symphysis. And that is a slightly movable joint as well. And at certain times, it can actually almost be freely movable, like during parturition. There are enzymes that dissolve that fibrocartilage away, and it allows for the disarticulation of the pubic bones. And what does that help? That enlarges the birth canal, okay? So it's easier for delivery. And that can happen to guys as well if they're riding a motorcycle and they crash and they go through the handlebars of the motorcycle, okay? That pubic symphysis splits wide open, but the nice thing, even after parturition, what happens to that joint? It more or less goes back to the way it was. Not exactly, but not quite. Okay. All right, so that would be a symphysis. All right, so we got fibrous, cartilaginous, and the third kind of structural classification is a synovial joint. These are the most interesting. All right, all of these joints are diarthrosis. Any kind of synovial joint is going to be what kind of joint?
Diarthrosis.
And what does that mean by function in like everyday language? Freely movable. So every kind of synovial joint is freely movable. Those are the ones that we use for moving around all the time. Okay, and they have a number of structural components associated with them. So I'm just going to talk about these various things. And I don't know what I had in here, if it disappeared or what, but we'll have to fill it in. All right, so here is an example of just a general kind of synovial joint. All right, so let's just zoom into this region right here. I guess I went too far. Here, oops. I want to go here. Ah, not bad. All right, so here is a freely movable joint, and that's a diarthrosis. So this is a synovial joint. We have the proximal bone and the distal bone. So since it's a diarthrosis, these bones are going to move with respect to each other when a muscle is going to pull on one or the other. All right, so to protect the ends of the bones, or these epiphyses, they're covered with hyaline cartilage. Sometimes we call hyaline cartilage articular cartilage, doesn't have any fiber in it. It's the weakest kind of cartilage, doesn't have blood vessels, so it's relatively easily damaged. And since it has no blood vessels, that means that it has very poor regenerative qualities. It doesn't regenerate once it becomes damaged. All right, and but it is very, very slippery, and it is lightweight. And early in life, it does protect the epiphyses of the bones because otherwise they would grind each other away. It is nourished by a fluid, right, which we call the synovial fluid. So there are living cells in this cartilage, and they are nourished by the synovial fluid. And that synovial fluid is, again, pretty slippery stuff, right? So it acts like a lubrication for the hyaline cartilage. And it's secreted by a membrane, right? And we call that the synovial membrane. And synovial fluid is secreted into what we call the joint cavity, right, by what we call weeping lubrication. And this fluid has a tendency to solidify and gel if you don't use that particular joint. Right? It doesn't form a solid like concrete, but it becomes very, very viscous, and it becomes more and more difficult to move that joint. So even if somebody has arthritis, for instance, and they're missing a lot of hyaline cartilage and the bones are kind of rubbing against each other, it's still recommended that they exercise their bodies, that they use their joints, because that promotes the proper fluid characteristics of that synovial fluid. And if somebody doesn't use a joint, it has a tendency just to what? To freeze up as a result. Okay? So even people with joint damage, they still have to use their joints or they will lose that mobility. Okay. There is a backing material to the synovial membrane because the synovial membrane is not very tough. And that backing material is what we call the fibrous capsule. That fibrous capsule has a lot of collagen fibers in it. And so that stabilizes the synovial membrane right here. So we tend to think of the synovial membrane plus the connective tissue sheath called the fibrous capsule as part of the articular capsule that completely surrounds the joint. Right? So the articular capsule has got one part that makes the synovial fluid and the other part that's very, very tough. And that's dense, irregular connective tissue in the joint capsule right here, or the fibrous capsule. All right, so that kind of describes a lot of this synovial joint, but there are some other structures as well. All right, and what we see is a bone-to-bone connection right here, which is a ligament. So that's dense, regular connective tissue that also helps stabilize this particular joint. Because there are a lot of joints where you can flex and extend, but you shouldn't be able to do any other kind of motion with it. And ligaments are real important for making sure a joint is used properly so it doesn't damage the epiphyses of the bones or the hyaline cartilage right here. All right, so a good typical kind of question would be, where do you find synovial fluid? You find synovial fluid in the joint cavity, right? And what are the two components of the articular capsule? It's the fibrous capsule and the synovial membrane. And of those two, which secretes synovial fluid into the joint cavity? It's the synovial membrane. So that's how you would use those terms, right? So this is a nice, easy exam figure for you to label. All right, so here is just another little illustration of a synovial fluid, and you can recognize this as a synovial fluid because I see a joint cavity right here with synovial fluid in there, and I can see some hyaline cartilage on the epiphyses of these bones. But this one is a little bit different because there is some connective tissue in the very center running transversely through the joint. And this is what we call an articular disc. And there are a few joints that have this little additional little feature in a synovial, a synovial joint, okay? In the knee, it's called a meniscus, and it's made out of fibrocartilage. There's another articular disc in our temporomandibular joint that helps stabilize that joint, and there's also one in the manubrial clavicular joint, between the clavicle and the manubrium. So there aren't very many, all right? But again, it just helps protect the ends of the bones. Right, so you can see the synovial membrane, the fibrous capsule, and don't forget the synovial membrane with fibrous capsule make the articular, what does it make? The articular capsule, and I don't know, this is all just the fibrous capsule. And then on the outside, you would have ligaments going from one bone to the other. All right. Okay. So the job of the synovial membrane and synovial fluid is just to provide lubrication and to defeat any kind of inflammation that might actually build up as a result of things rubbing up against each other, right, in a joint. So it prevents inflammation and provides for freely movable surfaces. There are a couple other structures that have the same job in joints. They're associated with joints, but they're not really part of the articular capsule. And these are called bursa and tendon sheaths. So right here, I see a bursa. And the way that I think of a bursa is that it's like a pillow. And it's placed between muscles and bones that are going to bang up against each other when a muscle is moving. All right? So if you have parts of your body that are going to rub up against each other or bang up against each other, then that's going to produce some kind of irritation and inflammation. So what is that process like? When something gets inflamed, guess what happens to it? It swells up, which means that it's going to rub more, which means it's going to get inflamed more, which means what? It's going to swell up even more. So it's going to get more inflamed, which means it's going to swell, which means it's going to inflame. So that's a really nasty positive feedback cycle that sometimes is very difficult to break. Right? So you don't like to have any inflammation in areas of your body anywhere. So there are bursa that are placed between different parts of your body that are going to be moving. And I think of a bursa as like a pillow that's going to absorb shock and provide lubrication. Right? And that pillow, really, you should use the model of the articular capsule to describe what a bursa is like. It has a fibrous capsule, and it has a synovial membrane, and it secretes into this internal cavity of a bursa synovial fluid, right, which is kind of a slippery substance. And so that allows, for instance, the capsule, the articular capsule of the shoulder joint, okay, to move very nicely up against the acromion process of the scapula without producing inflammation. But of course, you can over-exercise any joint by maybe inappropriate motion or overuse, and this bursa can become inflamed because of inappropriate use or overuse. And guess what it's going to do? It's going to swell up. And so instead of preventing inflammation, it actually contributes to inflammation of that particular joint. It's very painful, and guess what you call that? That's bursitis, right. And we have a number of bursa in various different places in our body, our hips, our knees, our shoulders, right? And if we overuse them, we just have to give them rest to get them to recuperate. And if that doesn't do it, then some anti-inflammatories have to be used, hopefully a mild course of anti-inflammatories. But if that doesn't even work, then you probably need cortisone shots to reduce that inflammation to get the swelling of the bursa back down. And then as the swelling decreases, so does the inflammation, and you can start to use that joint once again. Okay, so can you picture this bursa as like being a special kind of synovial joint, but it's really not protecting bones, it's really like a pillow between muscles and tendons or bones and tendons that are moving with respect to each other. Okay, so you can see the nice subacromial bursa over here between the head of the humerus and the coracoacromial ligament that keeps your shoulder from dislocating. Okay, so that's a pretty important joint. There's another structure that's very similar to a bursa, and we call this a tendon sheath. So here you have your shoulder, right? Here's your humerus, and there's a real important muscle in your anterior arm called the biceps. And it has a couple parts to it. That's why we call it biceps. It actually has two insertions. And one of the insertions, here's the tendon of the long head as opposed to the short head of the biceps brachii. And it actually enters The articular capsule of the shoulder goes through the synovial membrane and it attaches to the supraglenoid tubercle. So it actually forms a part of the shoulder joint. All right, and you know that you contract your biceps muscle all the time, so it's going to bang around inside the shoulder joint. But there's something that protects the shoulder joint, and that is a tendon sheath. So again, this tendon sheath, instead of like being just a nice little throw pillow right here, it wraps itself around the tendon, so when the tendon becomes really taut with tension and starts to bang around in there, this tendon sheath absorbs that shock, distributes the tension, and slips around so that inflammation doesn't develop in the shoulder joint. Okay, so that is what we call a tendon sheath. So a tendon sheath is really like a bursa, but it's what? It's surrounding a tendon. It's just not acting like a pillow between two places. All right, so, I don't think I'm going to test you on the shoulder in lab or in lecture, right? But it's such an interesting joint, and a lot of other lab classes will be tested on the shoulder. I just thought it would be really important for you guys to go over it. There's one other thing about a shoulder that can be damaged. There's some fibrocartilage right here, and right here. Actually, it completely surrounds, what do we call this little depression right here? It's part of the scapula that the head of the humerus articulates with. That's the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa. Right? And the glenoid cavity, you can see, is very shallow, but here is something that increases the depth of the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity to help stabilize the shoulder joint, and that fibrocartilage right there is called the glenoid labrum. Right? But as you can imagine, since it's only cartilage compared to bone, is it tougher than bone or more easily damaged than bone? It's more easily damaged because it's just fibrocartilage. It helps stabilize the shoulder joint, but it can be damaged if you overuse the shoulder or overextend it, right, or inappropriately use the shoulder joint. It can rip just like a meniscus in the knee can rip, right, and then probably it has to be removed if that happens. Okay, so that's the labrum. Okay, well, let's talk about some motions of joints. Let's see where we are in our discussion right here. Okay, we're doing good. All right, so this is kind of a fun part of the class to know how various parts of your body can move, right? And the motion of a synovial joint is determined by maybe three things. It's the shape of the ends of the bones that are coming together. So just the shape of a joint. Some joints can act like hinge joints. Some you have a lot more range of motion because they're ball and socket joints. The second thing that influences what happens at a joint and imparts stability to a joint are the ligaments that are between bones that go across the joint. And the third thing that's probably the most important, in my opinion, are the muscles that actually work across a particular joint. All right, so a way to think of this, for instance, if you damage your knee joint, there's very little we can do with the cartilage and the menisci, right? There's very little we can do to help the ligaments of the knee, right? We can't really shorten the ligaments, and with exercise and things like that, you can't really shorten the ligament. Once it's stretched out, it's going to be stretched out. But what you can do is that you can exercise the muscles that are associated with that joint. So to rehabilitate a joint, the thing that you have to do is work the muscles that are working across that particular joint. So if you want to rehabilitate a knee, you have to work the quadriceps muscles, right? And the hamstring muscles, that's what will, and maybe the gastrocnemius, that's what will regain stability for a particular joint. Or if your shoulder joint is damaged, what was the muscle that we said works across the shoulder? That would be the biceps brachii, right? So if you have shoulder damage, that's the muscle that you need to exercise to get strength back to the shoulder joint. Okay, so what are some motions? Well, we've got some gliding motions because these are very flat surfaces between the bones of the carpals, And this motion, okay, right here, so I'm in anatomic position. And if we move our hands away from midline, that's called abduction. And if we move it toward midline, that is adduction. So the same thing for your arms. You can move your arms away from midline, that's abduction. If you move your arms toward midline, that's adduction. So think of adding your limbs to your body, that is adduction. Abduction is moving farther away. So you can abduct and adduct your legs. You can abduct and adduct your fingers, like this, right? So what am I doing right now? Okay, yeah, I'm abducting and then adducting when you add them together, okay? So that's some motions that you should be aware of, all right? Extension and flexion. These are rotational movements as well, and if we think of the elbow joint right here, we can think of bones of the forearm and the arm, and right now they kind of just make a straight line, and so the angle between the bones is 180 degrees. So if we decrease the angle, like to 90 degrees or 45 degrees or something, that's what we call flexion. So decreasing the angle between two bones is flexion. Increasing the angle between two bones is what we call extension. So these are antagonistic motions, right? They are opposite to each other. The diagram that we have right here is motion of the cervical spine or of the neck. Right, so if we bend our head anteriorly like this, this is what we call flexion because we're decreasing the angle between the cervical spine and, say, the thoracic spine. Right, and then we lift our head back up. That's extension that goes back to 180 degrees. But the neck is kind of special. Unlike the elbow, we can actually tilt our head posterior like that, and that's called hyperextension. And that's fine within limits. Right, as long as you're not hit by somebody in your car from behind you and you whip your head back really violently. So you can hyperextend your neck. There's a lot of joints that you can hyperextend, but what about your elbow? Is that one of them? Cannot hyperextend your elbow, right, because of the shape of the joint. And if you do, well, something in there is going to break, unfortunately. All right, what about the knee? Okay, you can flex the knee, extend the knee, but you can't hyperextend. Right, maybe just a very, very slight degree of hyperextension, but not very much hyperextension. All right, so that's an easy joint to appreciate, flexion and extension. You can also flex and extend your shoulder. I don't know if I have a picture of that right here. That's a little bit more, so that's a flexion and extension of the lumbar spine, for instance. Ah, yes, we do. All right, so it's easy to see flexion and extension of the knee, or you could say flexion and extension of the leg, right? There's two different ways you could talk about it. At the particular joint or whatever part of your body is moving, you could talk about it that way. So the leg or knee is easy to see. Now what about the shoulder or the arm? We have flexion, okay, and extension, and so flexion, extension, and hyperextension, right? Now how are you going to remember which one of how that is moving? How are you going to know that this is hyperextension and not flexion? Because what's a classical definition for flexion? Is when the angle is for flexion, it is what? Decreasing. And extension is increasing. But do you see an angle anywhere that's being made between two bones? You know, I don't see any kind of angle there. So I was confused with this motion for years and years and years. But then I realized something, okay? Let's look at the thigh. Let's consider the hip joint. All right, so now, all right, it's 180 degrees from my thigh bone and, say, you know, my lumbar spine, for instance. And if I move my hip like this, but just think of the thigh, don't think of my leg, all right, the angle is decreasing. So what is that classical definition when the angle is decreasing? That's flexion, right? So this is flexion of the hip. This is extension of the hip. Hyperextension of the hip. All right, so that's easy to see, right, by angles. Now, pair the shoulder joint up with the hip. All right, so this is the same motion as the thigh. What is that? That's flexion of the humerus, extension of the humerus, hyperextension. All right, so if you want to remember what's happening to the humerus, just think of your femur, right, or your hip joint, and then it will make sense. That's the best I can do. But if somebody sees, you know, a more classic definition of flexion and extension of the arm, let me know. All right, I just don't see it. Okay. All right. So here's our adduction, abduction again. But the shoulder joint is a freely movable joint, but it's a special kind of joint. It's a ball and socket joint. It has a lot of degrees of freedom. So with the shoulder joint, we can, if I flex at the elbow and just consider the humerus, I can move my hand medially like this. That's what we call a medial rotation. Or you can move your hand laterally. That's a lateral rotation of the humerus. Right? Or if I put my hand down, right, I can rotate the humerus. And what else can you do? You can flex and extend. You can abduct and adduct. But if you combine all of these motions, right, with a ball and socket joint, if I'm drawing, what am I drawing in the air? A circle. We call that circumduction. So circumduction is kind of a combination of all those kinds of motions. And you can do that with ball and socket joints, like your hip and your shoulder. So that's circumduction. Okay, anybody here of rotator cuff? This is sort of interesting. Rotator cuff is a structure of the shoulder. Okay, and the rotator cuff has four components to it. It has muscles that actually become part of the articular capsule. And when you damage a shoulder, you damage the articular capsule as a result of those muscles pulling on the capsule. And it becomes really difficult to use. And people wonder all the time, how can I diagnose a rotator cuff injury or a tear? And a real easy way to do that, when somebody has rotator cuff, they cannot laterally rotate their humerus. So typically what somebody would do is they say, okay, bend your elbow. What do we call that? Flexion. That's flexion of the elbow or flexion of the forearm. It has nothing really much to do with the rotator cuff. All right. And then they say, okay, try to put pressure, all right, with your thumb on my hand. So you're trying to do what? A lateral rotation. And when somebody tries to do a lateral rotation with pressure, well, they just have excruciating pain. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that would be what? A really nice, simple diagnosis for a rotator cuff injury. Okay. Can it be repaired? Yes, it can. Depending on exactly what muscles were damaged, there are some surgical procedures that can build the rotator cuff back to where it's like twice as strong as it was before. Okay, but let's consider two joints, the shoulder versus the hip joint right here. One is really strong. Okay, and the other is relatively weak. Which one is the strong one? It's the hip joint, which is really, really strong, all right, compared to the shoulder. But how come your hip is so strong compared to your shoulder? What is given away? What's the trade-off? Less motion, right? You have less freedom with your hip compared to your shoulder. So when you get your shoulder rebuilt to make it strong, guess what you're giving away? You're giving some motion away, yeah. So it can be rebuilt to where it's twice as strong, but you lose some range of motion as a result, unless there's some newer kind of procedures I'm not aware of, okay? And guess what? Medicine is changing like every day, so nobody can possibly keep up with how everything is changing fast, right? So you can get shoulders rebuilt so that they're even stronger than before. That's pretty amazing. Okay. Rotation. Ah, a couple other motions. All right, having to do with your elbow joint. Okay, so usually you think your elbow can flex and extend, but you can also do something else really interesting with your elbow. All right, you can turn the palms of your hands so they face posteriorly, right, as opposed to being in an anatomic position. So when you're in anatomic position, we call that supinated. When your palms face posteriorly like this, we say that you are in a pronated position. So how can you remember that? Got a couple easy tricks. Okay. When your palms are facing posterior, that's pronated, so there's a bunch of P's that kind of line up. Palms, posterior, pronation. And then when your palms are anterior, well, there aren't a lot of consonants that line up. But if you put your palms together, it forms a soup bowl. Okay, so that's supinated when you're in anatomic position. So pronation, supination. Supination is the motion that brings your hands into a supinated position. Pronation is moving your hands into what? That pronated position. So can you, I don't know, maybe you can make sense of those little arrows right there. There's got to be something online. I haven't found an online video that shows this. But there's, if you find one, let me know on all these different motions. That would be pretty easy to do. Okay, a couple other motions right here. For instance, let's consider your wrist. So in your wrist, what is this motion like that? Yeah, up. Yeah, this is flexion. Okay, and this is extension, and your wrist can hyperextend, no problem. Okay. All right, now consider your ankle. Now, how are your ankles compared to your wrists? Is there any kind of way you can put your upper appendage to model what your ankles are going to do? Well, you can hyperextend your wrist, you know, and put your fingers forward like that. But look at which way your elbow is going to bend. It's going to bend the opposite way compared to your knee, right? So things are kind of twisted and rotated around in a funny way. So we don't talk about the ankle like we do a wrist. We don't just have flexion and extension, hyperextension, because of the twisting of your lower appendage. Both of the motions of your ankle are what we call flexion. Both are flexion, but we categorize it a little bit differently. If you flex your ankle so that your toes are pointed into the ground, we call that plantar flexion. You're planting your toes into the ground. But if you're lifting your toes up off the ground, okay, we call that dorsiflexion. All right, so plantar flexion and dorsiflexion, these are antagonistic motions of the ankle. So if you're gonna if you have trouble remembering this, just remember plantar flexion does what? Points your toes into the ground. Okay. These are really important motions. And if you go see a family practice physician or you go see your orthopod, they're going to be looking at you. All right. And as a matter of fact, they might be looking at the bottoms of your shoes and the tips of your shoes. Okay. Especially if you're an elderly patient. Because anybody have a clue what they might be looking for? Right there. Okay. Yeah, maybe pronation or supination. I don't talk about that in this class, so it's really important. But it's a combination of a couple motions. Okay. But dorsiflexion allows you to do what? What's it going to do? Lift your toes up off the ground. All right. So that's a really important motion. And what happens if you can't dorsiflex? If you can't lift your toes off the ground and you're walking, what's going to happen? Yeah, you're going to drag your toes on the ground. What's going to happen to your shoes? In the front, they're going to get worn out, all right? And if you're an elderly patient and you can't lift your toes up off the ground, that's a sign of a spinal cord injury is what that really means. But in every day, when we get to nervous system, you see why that has to do with spinal cord. But in everyday clinical reasoning, should you be aware of? Well, when somebody's dragging their toes on the ground because they're not dorsiflexing, What's a possible consequence of that? Tripping and falling, and if you're 80 years old and you fall, typically we have osteoporosis by that time. You can fracture a hip, right? You can't reconvalesce at home. You got to go into a nursing home, and you're away from your family and friends and things like that, and a lot of people get really disoriented, even with a fractured hip, and sometimes they don't even make it out of a nursing home because of that, because they just get so disoriented, they just give up the zest for life. Right, so knowing these proper motions is really important. You could maybe save somebody's life sometime because you might prevent them from falling down. Okay, just by looking at the tips of their shoes and appreciating whether or not somebody's dorsiflexing properly. Okay. Your shoulders. You can push your shoulders forward. You can pull your shoulders back. Pushing them forward is protraction. Pulling them back is retraction. You can do the same thing with your mandible, but don't chip a tooth. Right? You can stick your jaw out, your mandible out in front of you. That's protraction. You can draw it back in. That's retraction. So there's a couple of places in your body where you can do that. And all with the ankle, here's a standard kind of motion. Okay, if you move the sole of your foot so that it points medially, that's what we call inversion. Okay, so point the sole of your foot inversion like that. Oh, look at that. I can even stand on my lateral malleolus because I've sprained my ankle so many times. That's an easy kind of motion to undergo. You don't have a lot of ligaments stabilizing the ankle joint. Okay, but when you rotate or when you bend your foot so that the soles of your foot point outward, that's called eversion. There's a lot of ligaments and tendons that stabilize the joint in that direction, so it's relatively difficult to evert a foot due to trauma or when you sprain an ankle. But if you ever sprain an ankle through an eversion, right, that's a much more serious injury. You've damaged many, many more ligaments because it's a more stable kind of joint. All right, so that's eversion, inversion, dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. All right, so these are nice standard. Oh, a couple other motions. To open your mouth is what we call depression, okay? And then to close your mouth, we call that elevation. And we can do that with palpebrae as well. What's a palpebra? No one has the slightest idea unless you've taken an anatomy course already. That's your eyelid, okay? I don't know why they call them palpebrae. Why don't they just call them eyelids? But a palpebra, so you got a superior palpebra and an inferior palpebra. So to open your eyes, you got to what? You got to elevate your superior palpebra and what? Depress your inferior palpebra to open your eyes. So that's elevation and depression. And then opposition with your digits of your hand. So we've got a kind of a special hand compared to most mammals. Our first digit, not only can we adduct and abduct, right, but we can move this thumb anterior like this, so we call that opposition because it's kind of a complicated joint. We're going to see where that's a nice saddle joint in there. So it allows for two different kinds of motion, okay, opposition as well as abduction and adduction. And it even probably flexion to some degree and extension. So that's a really nice joint that allows us to grasp things. Okay, so here are some joints by shape. What did I not talk about right here? Supination, pronation. I think I talked about all of these things right here. Okay. All right, so what stabilizes a joint? We said it was the shape of the joint itself, of the articulating bones, ligaments that go across the bones, and probably even most importantly are the muscles that work across that particular joint. But let's take a look at the shape of some joints. All right, so we got plane, which allows for sliding of two bones, like intercarpal joints. We have some hinge joints, and a hinge joint, just think of like a hinge on a door. And what can a door do? Yeah, it can open and close. So it can only flex and extend, right? It can't abduct, adduct, unless it's a really special kind of door of some kind, right? But it can only open and close. So some examples of that would be the ankle between the tibia and fibula and the talus, the elbow between the humerus and the ulna. Right, that's purely a hinge joint. Right, where you get supination and pronation is actually between the radius and the ulna, and or the radius and the humerus. But the joint between the humerus and the ulna is strictly a hinge joint. And interphalangeal joints, those are joints of your digits. Right, so those you can flex and extend, and that's it. But you can't abduct or adduct, right, the interphalangeal joint. If you do, that's bad news, right? Something's going to break in there, right? So those are just hinge joints. So what do those joints kind of look like? Okay, hinge joints, right? Like between the trochlear and the trochlear notch, right? They just fit together, and it only allows for flexion and extension. We call that a uniaxial joint because it can only move in those directions. All right, so did the color match up? Does it match this uniaxial right here? Okay. Okay, pivot joints. A good example would be between the head of the radius and the radial notch in the ulna. And here is a ligament that holds the head of the radius right in the radial notch right here. And that allows for pronation and supination so that the radius can just pivot right in that joint. All right, condyloid joints. It's like a modified ball and socket. Okay, so this is a multi-axial motion. All right, so can you picture this in your body? Where is that at? That's between the metacarpals and the proximal phalanx right here. So what can you do with that joint between your hand and your digit joint? You can abduct and adduct, but you can also flex and extend, right? So we call that multi-axial. If you could only flex and extend like an interphalangeal joint, then that would just be a hinge. But it's not just a hinge joint, right? It's a condyloid joint so that you have more degrees of freedom, more motion at that particular joint. Okay, and then we have a special joint between this carpal and the number one metacarpal right here. This is what we call a saddle joint. So this is what? At the base of the thumb. So this is the one that allows for abduction, adduction, flexion, extension, as well as opposition. Right, so we don't have many joints in our body like that. We don't have many saddle joints. And this particular joint, you know, this is the one that probably degrades the most rapidly in our body, becomes the most arthritic as we get older. Okay, is that joint right at the base of the thumb because it just has so much range of motion to it. And then lastly, the ball and socket joint, like a hip or shoulder joint where there is a depression. For instance, a glenoid fossa in the head of the humerus. All right, so where do you have another ball and socket joint? Between the?
Hip.
Yeah, the hip. So what would this part of the hip be called?
Acetabulum,
and then this would be the head of the femur, right? Okay, so those are ball and socket joints, and that's a multi-axial joint as well. Okay. All right, now there is an important joint that I would like you guys to become familiar with in lab and for lecture, and that's the knee. That's actually a pretty easy joint to get to know pretty intimately, and there's some good exercises online for looking at that. So let's see if I can find the knee joint. Where's a good knee joint at? Okay, here's probably the best one. This is a good place for us to start. Okay, so here's a knee. That's good enough. All right, so let's talk about the bones that make up the knee joint. We got four bones that make up the knee. So the bone of the thigh we call the femur, right? And then we got a couple bones in the leg. All right, we got this one right here. That's the tibia. Now, is that the medial or lateral one? Yeah, tibia is medial, right? It makes up the medial malleolus, so your medial ankle bone is sticking out right there. So that means the fibula is the lateral one, you know, and you can actually palpate during a test if you mix that up on a board exam or something. Just reach down to your leg and you feel your shin bone and there's going to be nothing medial to it. That's the big, huge tibia sticking out right there, right? And the fibula, you can't really palpate because it's underneath so much muscle, right? So you should never get that confused. Right, so tibia is medial. So here are a couple ligaments that go from the femoral medial epicondyle down to the tibia. So here is a ligament. Remember, a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. And this is what we call a collateral ligament. And you could call it, it's got a couple names. You could call it the medial collateral ligament because the tibia is medial, or you could call it the tibial collateral ligament. And we're going to talk about what the function of these things are in just a second, but let's get the names down first. Then on the lateral side, you've got a corresponding ligament from the femur down to the fibula. And so this is what we call what? The lateral collateral ligament. Or you could call it the fibular collateral ligament. All right? And what these ligaments do, prevent the knee from bending from side to side at the knee. So these prevent abduction and adduction because the knee really is what? It's just a hinge joint. You shouldn't bend your knee sideways right there. I mean, it happens, unfortunately, due to trauma, but what does that mean? That means that one of these collateral ligaments is going to get ruptured. It's going to pull off the bone or it's going to rip apart. Okay, so those are a couple important ligaments. Another couple important ligaments are ligaments that cross over each other. So we like to call these cruciate ligaments because they cross over each other. They're deep inside the knee, kind of right on midline of the knee. And the anterior one is what we call the anterior cruciate ligament, and the posterior one is the posterior cruciate ligament. Right, so they go from the intercondylar notch, which is on the posterior side between the condyles, and they insert into what? That intercondylar eminence between the condylar surfaces of the tibia. So that's why you have that nice eminence there when you look at a tibia. It's for the cruciate ligaments that attach. Okay, what about another ligament? So don't forget, a ligament is what? A bone-to-bone connection. So that takes us to our fourth bone of the knee. And that fourth bone is the kneecap, otherwise known as the patella. So here's the patella. And there is dense regular connective tissue that goes from the patella to the tibial tuberosity. And we call that the patellar ligament. All right. On the other end of the patella, the base of the patella, there is a tendon. What the heck's a tendon? Yeah, it's a muscle-to-bone connection. And the muscle that attaches to the patella right here is called the quadriceps femoris because it's in the femoral region of your body. And so there are actually four muscles that have a common insertion into the patella. And when it pulls on the patella, that's basically pulling on the tibia because it's all connected together. Okay, so this is easy to understand. And when the quadriceps contracts, it pulls on the anterior part of the tibia, and it does what? What does that do? When these muscles contract, it pulls on the anterior part of the tibia, and it extends the knee as a result of that, or extends the leg. Either way, you can talk about it. All right, the tibiofibular ligament, we don't have to know for this particular diagram. So that's mostly everything, except for the articular discs that are inside the knee, all right, that are important for stabilizing the knee. And notice they look like the letter C, so they're C-shaped fibrocartilage discs inside the knee that we call menisci. And there's a medial one and a lateral one. So this, guess which one this is right here? Yeah, because it's associated with the tibia, so that's the medial meniscus. And here is the lateral meniscus. So this is the big, thick part of the meniscus, right, on the edges of the tibia. And as it moves toward midline, the menisci become actually pretty thin, right? And so these are the areas, the thin tips of the menisci are the parts that are most easily damaged. They can rip or completely rip off or partly rip off. And if they partly rip off, they're just going to flap around inside the knee. Okay, I know I shouldn't talk about this too much because it's uncomfortable. And you know, you could lock your knee up if this little wedge gets wedged in some part of your knee. Okay. It used to be when somebody had a tear of a meniscus, it would just, the whole thing would be removed. Okay, years ago. And we've now realized that that's a really bad thing to do because these menisci are in your knee doing what? They're protecting the ends of the bones. So now when somebody rips a meniscus, they do some really nice imaging studies to find out where the rip or the tear is, and then a minimal amount of the meniscus is removed, and that just maximizes what some remainder part, and that just protects the articulating surfaces of the femur and the tibia, and that prevents the development of arthritis in the knee. Right? So we try to preserve as much healthy tissue as possible. And the meniscus don't repair because they don't have a vascular supply. Yeah?
What is the reason in sports injuries, why is it say it's like the most common, always torn ACL?
Yes. Let's take a look about what these ligaments actually do. Maybe I'll show you another picture. But you know what I need to do? I need to just get a sign-in sheet started around someplace. Anybody have a piece of paper to put around? Okay, so let's talk about what... Now, ligaments have collagen in them, so ligaments don't stretch. They're not designed to stretch. They're not like elastic tissue. You should think of them as like a steel cable, right, that shouldn't stretch. All right, so let's take a look at this next figure, right? Oh, this is a pretty good place to start. All right, so here we have anterior cruciate ligament, posterior cruciate ligament, right? So this anterior cruciate ligament should not stretch. So what is it doing? It's preventing the protraction of the tibia with respect to the femur, all right? So keep the in your mind, keep this femur in this spot right here, right? And notice that this anterior cruciate ligament should prevent the anterior motion of the tibia, because this anterior cruciate ligament shouldn't stretch at all, okay? But what happens if you come from behind the knee with excessive force and it actually moves the tibia anterior, it protracts the tibia? It's going to rip that anterior cruciate ligament. So an anterior cruciate ligament tear is due to too much force from behind the individual that's moving their leg out in front of them. Okay? Why that's the most common kind of thing, you know, I don't know. But I don't know if I could agree or disagree with you. I don't have all the statistics on the tip of my tongue, you know, what the most common is. But certainly that is a very, very common kind of injury, okay, an ACL tear. This posterior cruciate ligament does what? It prevents the retraction of the tibia. And so I would guess that would be a fairly common injury too. When you get hit from the front on your shin, forcing your tibia back and the rest of your body is stationary. Okay, so that would be the posterior cruciate ligament tear. Right, so here you can see the quadriceps muscle, the tendon of the quadriceps, and the patellar ligament. Very nice right here. But you know what? Just as easy, not for damaging the cruciate ligaments, but you can also damage the collateral ligaments as well, right? Because the knee should just be what? A hinge joint. Flexion and extension should not abduct or adduct. So with an impact from the lateral aspect of the knee, from that side of the knee, lateral side, okay? What's the motion that's happening now at the knee? Is that abduction or adduction? This is moving away from midline, so that's abduction. So when the knee abducts due to this trauma, that wrecks what? The medial collateral ligaments, right? But trauma from the medial side of the knee is going to wreck the lateral collateral ligament. And a lot of times when you experience trauma, you know, you just don't have one force. There's twisting, and you might be hit from a number of different directions at one time. So a lot of things could get screwed up in there. All right, so that's the purpose of those different ligaments inside the knee. All right, so this is a really good exam figure that you should know. And we got really nice models in lab. Did we go over this model last time? Yeah, nice, okay. Okay, so that's it for joints. All right, so that's it for the test. So we still got a couple minutes left. So I think I want to talk about muscle a little bit, unless somebody can think of some good questions about joints. Anybody have any questions on joints at all? And let's see, what about your practicum? You got a practicum Wednesday? Oh, no, you took it last week. Okay, the bones last week. Okay. You know, if anybody wants to see their practicum tonight after class, I have them so we can meet outside or whatever. Okay. All right. Well, you know what? I do want to talk a little bit about muscle because that can be a little bit complicated to get started off. So sometimes it really helps if I talk about something more than just one time. So this could be the first time. So that is chapter 10. Chapter 10. Thank you so much. Okay. And what do I have for text slides? Maybe something. Oh, I'm glad I pulled this up because I would have forgotten to talk about some of this stuff. Okay, introduction to muscle. Functions of muscle. All right, so muscle is a tissue all by itself. What are the three other kinds of tissues you got in your body? Nervous tissue. Epithelium. Epithelium covers surfaces, lines cavities. Nervous tissue sends electrical information rapidly over long distances in your body. And connective tissue that connects different parts of your body together, provides support. All right, and so muscle, what's the function of muscle? What is muscle specialized to do?
Contract,
right? So it contracts with power, with force. All right, so because of that, muscle is important for movement, because muscle, two ends of a muscle might be connected to two different bones, and those bones, when a muscle contracts, move closer together. All right, so motion is really important. But something else is really important. Even if you're not moving, you're using a lot of muscles. Like right now, we're just sitting down, all right? But if all the muscles were to relax in your body, what would happen? Well, your head would hit the table and bounce, right? And then it would hit the chair and bounce, and it would hit the floor and probably bounce a couple times, right? So muscles, right, provide for posture, keep your body in a certain position, and keep joints in a certain position so they don't get damaged even though you're really not in motion. So posture is really good. Muscles are important for joint stabilization, to make sure that joints only move in the prescribed ways so that bones don't become damaged, so that ligaments don't rip or menisci get torn. Okay, and then the fourth function of muscle is to generate body heat. So right now, are you at room temperature? Absolutely not, because if you were, right, you'd be dead. Room temperature is in maybe high 70s, maybe in the 70s somewhere, but your body temperature is 98 point something, right? So you're way different than room temperature, and what keeps your body temperature warmer than room temperature is all the muscles that are generating heat for us. And that's real important, that your temperature is stable, because it allows enzyme reactions to proceed at the same kind of rate, and you're just basically a bag full of biochemistry, chemical reactions, and those reactions wouldn't take place at a lower than normal body temperature. Okay. So there are some special functional characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other kinds of tissue, and that is, we said that, well, muscle can't contract. This is really true. Nerves can't contract, right? Connective tissue doesn't contract, like blood doesn't contract, really. And muscles are excitable. So that means that they can be relaxed and long, or when you excite them, they actually can be controlled into contracting at a particular force or at a particular rate. So they are excitable. Now, I wouldn't really call an epithelium excitable. All right, it's just covering a surface. It has receptors, but it can't really respond, right, like a muscle can. All right, another characteristic is that it is extensible. Muscle, as opposed to bone and opposed to tendons and ligaments, means that a muscle can stretch, right? And it's really healthy for muscles to stretch. So not only do they contract, but they're designed to actually stretch out. And that leads us to the fourth characteristic, and that is elasticity. So that after you stretch a muscle out and let go of that tension, what does that muscle do? It goes back to its original resting length. Right, so it's okay to stretch a muscle, but not overstretch it, and then when you relax, it goes back to its original length. And that's really important, that extensibility and elasticity, because, for instance, there are a couple muscles that control flexion and extension of the forearm. So flexion is due to contraction of the biceps muscle. Extension is due to contraction of the triceps muscle. These are antagonistic to each other. Right, so when the biceps contracts, guess what has to happen to the triceps? When the biceps gets shorter, guess what has to happen to the triceps? It has to stretch out. Okay, it has to elongate. And then when you relax, that triceps goes back to its original shape because of the elastic properties. All right, just like if you contract the triceps, guess what the biceps has to do? It's got to stretch. All right, even though it's relaxed, it's got to stretch. And then when you relax everything, those muscles go back to their original resting length. So these are important properties of muscle. And from histology, you probably remember there are three kinds of muscle tissue. There is skeletal muscle. Tell me something about skeletal muscle. It's multinucleate. Yes, it has a number of nuclei, which is strange for cells because most cells only have one nucleus.
Striated.
It is striated. This is true. But so is cardiac muscle. We're going to see where those striations come from. Maybe not today, but next time real soon. Okay? It is, that's what I was really thinking of in my mind. It is, yeah, it's hard to read my mind sometimes. It is voluntary, right? So skeletal muscle is voluntary. It's under control of your mind. As a matter of fact, that's the only thing in your whole body that you have control of. Everything else gets taken care of automatically by a part of the nervous system called the autonomic nervous system, right? So cardiac muscle, it's kind of scary actually to think of that. It's the only thing you have control of, right? Besides your thoughts, I suppose. All right. The other kinds of muscle would be cardiac muscle that makes up your heart. You don't have control over that. Okay. It's controlled by your autonomic nervous system, but you can influence it a little bit, I suppose. It's involuntary muscle. You know, I could say, okay, let's have a pop quiz just for fun. So what happened to your heart rate? It probably went up a little bit, right? Not that I really had control of it, but right, you can mess around with your heart rate a little bit like that, but it's not like contracting a skeletal muscle, okay? And smooth muscle that you find in digestive system and reproductive system and respiratory system. So these are in the walls of hollow organs, and again, you don't have control over these things. These are smooth muscles controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Muscle cell, that if it's skeletal or smooth muscle, we call these fibers because they're long and narrow. They kind of look like a fiber. But cardiac muscle, we don't really say that it's a fiber because it's not long and narrow. It actually has branches to it, right? So it's not like a single thread or a fiber. All right, so that's some characteristics. And you should probably know some other characteristics of these different types. Like cardiac muscle is striated as well as skeletal. Smooth muscle is not striated, but cardiac and smooth do have something in common. They are involuntary, right? Skeletal muscle stands out because there's only it has many nuclei. Cardiac and smooth only have one. So some muscle types share characteristics that, but they don't all share the same characteristics. Smooth muscle is not striated, okay? But cardiac and skeletal muscle is because we're going to see what kind of structures they have inside the cell. All right. Then I think I just wanted to start. Oops, that's not it. Where did it go? Here? Here. All right. So I'm just going to talk about this a little bit, and then that will be it for today. So here we have a bone, and a bone to muscle connection is called a tendon, right? And that's dense regular connective tissue. So a lot of collagen fibers, and that connective tissue is continuous with a connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole muscle. And I'm talking about a muscle that's an organ because it has muscle tissue in it, it has nervous tissue, it has connective tissue, blood vessels, right? So an organ is something that's made out of all different kinds of tissues, not just one kind of tissue. So a muscle is an organ. And that connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole organ is what we call the epimysium. So anytime you hear mesio or mesium, that has to do with muscle. Epi means what? On the surface of this particular muscle. And if we have a nice transverse section across these muscles, or this muscle organ, we see that it has some structure on the inside of it. It has these different bundles. These bundles are what we call fascicles. And these fascicles are wrapped with connective tissue sheath, right, which then also, as you get to the ends of the muscle, connects up to the epimysium, which connects to the tendon, which then, you know, connects to the bone right here. So the fascicle is surrounded by something we call the perimysium. something that surrounds a fascicle. Sometimes fascicles are called muscle bundles. A bundle or a fascicle is the same thing. But if we look inside a fascicle, we see what? Even more structures. And this is not drawn to scale. These structures inside of a fascicle are the muscle cells. So you can't really see a muscle cell with your naked eye, but it's just drawn for illustrative purposes right here. And there's a connective tissue sheath around every muscle cell. So when a muscle cell contracts, it pulls on that sheath, which is the endomysium, which then pulls on the perimysium, which then pulls on the epimysium, which then pulls on the tendon, which then starts to move your bones around for you for motion. Okay? So I want you to know the building blocks of these things. So what is the basic building block of a muscle? The organ. Muscle, the organ. The basic building block of a muscle is this bundle right here, which we call a fascicle. So a muscle is made up of fascicles. And what is a fascicle made up of? What's the building block of a fascicle? Muscle cell. Many, many muscle cells. All right. Now, furthermore, we need to look inside that muscle cell. It has a building block as well. Okay. So here is a muscle cell. This is a skeletal muscle cell. It's long and linear. It has a number of nuclei. It's surrounded with a cell membrane. But that cell membrane, we can see kind of reflected away right here. The cell membrane is what we call the sarcolemma. So if you hear the term sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle. Right? That's on the outside. So if we look inside the cell, we see what? Other structures inside the muscle cell, and these are what we call myofibrils. So a myofibril is a building block of a muscle cell. And what other things did you find inside of a cell when we did cytology? What are some other things you found inside of a cell? Mitochondria. What's a general name for mitochondria? A general name like Golgi apparatus and endoplasmic reticulum. Those are all organelles, right? So mitochondria is an organelle, and I actually want you to think of a myofibril as an organelle, but it's an organelle specialized for contraction, right? So that's the organelle of contraction is a myofibril. So you know what? We'll probably start maybe close to this slide next time, right? So I want you to get a feel for the different building blocks of a muscle. Okay, and if anybody needs a sign-in sheet, I got it here. Who wants to take a look at their practicum? Anybody want to see their practicum? Okay, I'll just meet you outside because there might be a class in here afterwards.